Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. And before we get started this morning, I'd like to thank all those hosts who filled in last week while I enjoyed time back in Pennsylvania with my family and friends for the first time since the pandemic began. Coming up this morning at 9:30, we'll open up the phones until 10, and then we have another book show. That's from 10 to 11 this morning. But we open the program by getting to chat with Paul Costello, who's been the executive director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development for the past 21 years. Paul's retiring this month, and I wanted to make sure we spent some time speaking with him about what he's been able to accomplish during his tenure and what he sees for the future of rural development in the state. Paul Costello, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. So good of you to have me.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question for Paul or if you want to share a story about working with Paul and the council, you can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Paul, when you took over 21 years ago, what goals had you set for the council?
Well, the council had set its own goals. I'm more of a facilitator than above the council, and the board had been looking at working lands issues, agriculture, forest products. You know, where are those industries, and where are they going to go, and what do they need for support to achieve their, you know, optimize their role in rural community development. We also were looking at water and sewer issues all over the state, which were sort of fundamental. And then broadband. We built in 2000 the first sort of cross-sectional broadband committee with the goal of dedicated to universal broadband and affordable service throughout the state. And that group bridged the congressional offices, cities and towns, nonprofits, and ultimately brought ideas around setting broadband goals to Jim Douglas and Governor Shumlin, and really worked locally and in state policy to promote the expansion of broadband over the years.
How do you think you did at accomplishing those goals?
Well, we're never quite done, and it's right. going to be a moving target with the technologies we're going to need in the future. But when you think about it, we've made tremendous progress. Back then, it was probably 55, 60% of Vermonters had broadband at all. There were huge swaths of the state that had nothing, and lots of places with just DSL. So we've seen a tremendous leap forward, and yet there's lots of work still necessary in the community broadband projects across the state right now are really vital and really important, and I'm optimistic that we're on the right track.
What was your background prior to going to work for the council?
Well, it was a little bit eclectic. I have a degree in psychology, and I had a
of course.
6 or 7 years career in human services. And then I turned a corner and got a master's in history and then a PhD in intellectual history, like the history of European thought. Not very practical.
We can switch the topic today if you'd like.
No, that's okay. And then I couldn't find a job for the life of me. And I got hired ultimately by Mary Leahy and the Central Vermont Adult Basic Education as an organizer in Orange County, organizer teacher. We got a lot of volunteers connected to students, a lot of people who were really trying to pick themselves up by their bootstraps, you know, people who'd had a lot of challenges with literacy or with getting through high school and were trying to make, you know, really improve their lives, take control of their lives. And it was really inspiring. And I really learned a lot about volunteers and how to work together with people to solve social problems. But I also learned, ultimately, they made me their fund development officer, and I learned how to ask for money. I learned how to think systemically about program development. Started working with people like Con Hogan and others. Got on about 10 different boards. And then when this job came open 21 years ago, it seemed like a long stretch for me. But they were looking for someone who was sort of ready to step up to the next level, and it was a great opportunity for me, and it's been inspiring work ever since.
Well, what is something that you're particularly proud of accomplishing as executive director?
I guess the first thing that you're proud of in this work is the people you get to work with at the local level. You know, we hear a lot about the challenges of economic doldrums, the loss of youth. You know, we worry about our rural communities. But in my world, you're in those communities, and you see these people who are working to drive things forward. There's incredible diligence. There's incredible care. You know, patriotism of place in Vermont mm-hmm. is still really strong, and it can be really unifying. So you see people who really lift their communities up. You see people who rally others together. And it's tremendously inspiring to see. And it gives you a more optimistic perspective on the future of these towns.
Interesting that you mentioned that patriotism of place. I was at a picnic on Saturday in South Hero, and a lot of the people were from South Hero. And, you know, I've never heard so much almost like boosterism, pride mm-hmm. in that community. Mm-hmm. You know, and I go to South Hero. I think it's a fine place. But until you sit and meet the people and talk to them, and what makes it so connected is really incredible to find that out.
Yeah, you know, and in a time with such fractured politics and mm-hmm. and, you know, where everyone's getting pulled in different directions in their cars, and where social media divides us into pools of mutual distrust, it's that kind of localism and thinking together about what you can do locally to drive your community forward that can be really unifying and lift you up. And it also brings together people who are different from each other. And, you know, we need to listen to each other. We need to learn together. And democracy is sort of like a process of learning and making decisions. Mm-hmm. And it's never perfect, but it's like an evolution. And communities need that. And it's often founded on that local pride of place, local support for local businesses, local connection to the land and the assets of a place.
Well, there are so many demands in a rural community, things like select boards, school board, volunteer fire department, that falls on just a few thousand people, sometimes 1,000 people or a few hundred. So is it sustainable for these communities to continue thriving, even surviving on, you know, the backs of a kind of a finite number of people?
What a great question, Rick.
Right?
Yeah, right. Well, and you think about those commissions and those boards and we look at this all the time, and, you know, we get invited into communities for them to think about how they go from the 100 issues they're trying to solve to, you know, what are the two or three things that they're going to drive forward in the next year, and how do they engage the full public in both deciding those issues and then lining up so that there's the power of the community behind the directions that they set. So we're really involved in that. But we also see systemically, you know, there are towns, small towns with three different volunteer fire departments. And God love them, right? That's an amazing dedication. But you may also have a food shelf and, just one after another kind of nonprofit. We have more nonprofits than any place in the country per capita. Mm-hmm. It's a great richness to that, right? But we also have no county government,
right?
So that everything falls to these local committees. And you go to some towns, and there are individuals who are on 7 or 8 boards or even more. And then there's often people in the hills who see all these people who are always engaged in all these boards, and they think, oh, they're doing it. They don't really need or want us.
Right.
And they haven't been invited. And so there's this sort of tension. And it's a tension with an opportunity in it, which is to invite that next generation, invite newcomers, invite quiet creatives living in the hills to be part of the dynamic of people who are engaged in volunteerism and driving things forward. And then we need to look at efficiencies. You know, without county government, how many dispatchers do we need for police and fire in a small region? How many, you know, how do we think structurally around community and economic development? Regionally, we have great regional development corporations, regional planning commissions, but do they work as effectively as they could? How do state services get delivered to rural communities? We've talked to chiefs of staff of governors in the past who say that the system is one that's accreted, you know, it's grown with time, but if you were rationally organizing the state of Vermont, would you look at it a little differently in terms of the way that state services get out of Montpelier or Waterbury and actually participate in localized offices. Again, without county office or county government, you don't have that much rationalization of local service and regional service delivery as we might.
Paul, I'm listening to you speak. You've got all this institutional knowledge. You're a fixer, but you're retiring. So why is this the right time for you to retire? You sound like a guy who has some answers, not ready to give it up.
Well, I'm not retiring. I'm stepping down from this position. I do think it's time. I think 21 years in any job is a long time.
Yeah.
I think we've established a set of structural ways of looking at community and economic development. We've worked with 80 different towns with this full range community visit process that brings people together. It takes about 6 months, really helps a community set its direction, connect to resources, drive on those new projects and so forth. And we've done probably 10, 12 different policy councils. We've done private retreats for governors of both parties that help them set framework. And we get involved in all kinds of facilitation where, because our neutrality is sacred to us and because we respect the leadership of the people we bring together, we're useful, you know, and that's a great thing. But there's a time for new energy. It's a time for generational transition. I think that I feel like I've done a good job carrying this organization forward in creative ways for over 20 years. And now it's time for a relook and a renewal of this organization. And I don't know what exactly that looks like. And it feels like it's not my job to do that.
I got you. Paul, do you have plans for your retirement? Anything you're hoping to do? Any big trip, mission, something?
No, you know, I've always been an outdoors person, and so I plan to spend time outdoors. But then I think, you know, one thing I've decided is I'm not going to do anything for 2 months. I'm not going to get on a board. I'm not going to be part of anything particular organized. I'm just going to enjoy myself and be outside. So travel may be part of that, but, you know, there's a lot of hiking and canoeing and other beautiful activities right here in Vermont. But then beyond that, I really don't know. And in some ways, I'm jumping off a little cliff. And I'm interested in thinking about how to be useful. But I also really want to have a better work-life balance, have more time outside, more time, you know, growing my garden, things like that.
Touche. Now, why do you think it's important to maintain and to develop our rural communities, something you've been dedicated to for the past two decades?
Well, you know, Vermont's the second most rural place in the United States. I think that Vermont has tremendous opportunities to model ways for rural America to move forward. You know, we always worry about demographics in Vermont and, you know, the studies of the loss of youth and the aging population in Vermont makes the whole state look sort of demographically more challenged than other states. But it's really because of the rural nature of the state. If you look at rural parts of other states, like Western states and Midwest states, they're often more carved out than we are. They are often more challenged, and the demographic as a whole for their state doesn't look as bad because they have major urban centers like Boise, Idaho. But rural Idaho has got lots of challenges. And I rode my bike across the country about 10 years ago and went through all these little downtowns, a bit of a busman's holiday. Went through 300 small towns, and a lot of these towns in the Midwest are really boarded up. There's empty storefronts. There's a lack of local commerce. People have moved out of the natural land, like natural resource economy of farm and forestry, to live in urban centers, and then guys drive out, get on a harvester for a day, contract work, or spread manure for a day and drive back home to this town. You know, it's and the countryside is empty, and you don't see people walking. You don't see kids. It's really different. And Vermont has got something really special in that balance of working lands and urban centers. And you think about even the success of Chittenden County is partly dependent on the beauty of Vermont, the outdoor recreation opportunities, the connection to a food system that's really dynamic. The breweries, you know, the whole nine yards of the Vermont identity. So I, you know, people pit Chittenden County against the rest of Vermont. That's all nonsense. we're really rich in that connection. And meanwhile, rural folks are in Vermont are very creative. They're resourceful. The growth of the food system economy is out there. The growth of the energy economy is out there. When we look at climate change and our resilience in the future, we're seeing the growth of energy generation, smart grid development, battery storage businesses. Like there's a whole panoply, a cluster of economic activity that Vermont is building as solutions and that we're modeling in rural Vermont alongside of Burlington and other places. And so to me, that richness is like Vermont's a golden goose. You know, it's our brand. It's who we are. And it's what attracts people here. And it's also part of the other thing about Vermont that we all really love, I think, is the sense of community and scale and neighborliness. Like we know each other. We can walk in the state house without going through a metal detector. You can grab the lieutenant governor or governor in the hall of the state house and have a chat. It's really different than New York or Illinois. Yeah. And that scale of interconnectivity and almost family feeling in different communities is really incredibly valuable, I think.
What's a community that you've seen develop in a very positive ways since you started the council back in 2000?
Well, gosh, it's hard to single out one when there's so many that are doing such great work. You know, we've had community processes in towns that have just taken off. And I often refer to Johnson, not because it's better, mm-hmm. but because it really epitomizes some of the ways that these things can work. And in Johnson, they were looking at downtown redevelopment. They were looking at some water and sewer issues. They were looking at streetscape. People came and were very frustrated at the state of their low-income housing in the community. So they had this panoply of issues, and then people said, nobody knows what's going on anymore. You know, we have bubbles of community within the community. We have the Veterans Group. We have the Downtown Association. We have the municipality. We have the Arts Circle. We have the College on the Hill Veterans Group. They all have their own invitation lists, and they're all separate. We get in our cars, and we leave town, and we come back, and we only connect with people who are like us, and we're losing the community itself. And so, you know, these kinds of issues are everywhere a little bit. But in Johnson, they decided to attack them. And in this process, they built a task force around housing. They redeveloped a whole neighborhood of pretty beat-up houses for working people to live in. They were already starting to think about their downtown redesign, but they pulled everything together, and we brought the congressional offices, the Agency of Commerce, Agency of Transportation, all the key leadership they needed together to think about that streetscape in a coherent way, doing the water sewer first so you wouldn't have to open up the streets later. And they captured significant federal funding from the congressional, you know, our congressional delegation and other support. So kind of a home run. At the same time, they built a committee to work on town communications and connecting. And after a couple of meetings, they decided they didn't want to just talk about communicating. You know, they wanted to do something. And so they set up their Thursday Night Live concert series on the Green. And they got people from all those different working groups to be part of the same team, to pool their invitation lists, to look at a schedule that would have young people in hip-hop one week, country music the next. Each group could put on their own kinds of shows, and the entire community would be invited together. And just so unifying and uplifting in terms of the kinds of positive stuff that happen. We see these things happen all over the place. Sometimes our process will lead to major, big picture redevelopment projects, like redoing a major derelict building or redoing water and streetscape. But other places, it's more free things, where you put your back to the plow together and you are able to accomplish things just on your own energy and equity, sweat equity.
Interesting. I did a story once on the Johnson, the folks who were involved in the trees downtown that were kind of being choked off because of everything else, and they brought back, you know, just a tiny little part of that streetscape that makes a difference when you go through a town like Johnson and see that vibrance in everything, including even the trees that line the streets. What are the biggest challenges you see for the rural communities as you step down?
Well, you know, we've been deeply engaged in responding to COVID for the last year and a half. We shifted out of community visit organizational stuff to start bringing people together community to community that were doing COVID response work. And then the governor asked us to chair his community solutions task, part of the task force for recovery. And so we went out and we talked to 1,200, 1,300 people. We then interviewed former governors, young people of color, lead business people, you know, a real diverse group of Vermonters to say, ask just that kind of question. Mm-hmm. And we've built a framework based on that conversation that we call the Vermont Proposition that describes what Vermonters think are the things that we need to look at over the next 3 years. And mostly they're not surprises. It's more like they are self-evident truths of our time. We need to look at climate change and becoming much more dynamically a place that builds climate solutions, both because it's the right thing to do, but also because we can capture market share in a global economy that's going to be centered around not, you know, low carbon solutions. We need to look at advancing racial justice and becoming known for that, as well as marketing that to attract people of color to the future of our communities. The economic doldrums we face, the demographic challenges we face, say that this is a clear answer, and it's the right thing to do, but it also is beneficial to Vermont's future. Pre-K, mm-hmm. And every family knows that we're at a crunch point, and we need to build a systematic solution to that as a challenge so that we become one of the most family-friendly places in the United States. If we can't attract workforce, we can't attract the people we need to do jobs here, that's going to be one of the fundamentals. Then universal broadband.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to ask you to stick around. I know I only asked you to stay here at 9:30. Can you stay a little longer?
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. We'll go up to maybe 9:45 and get you out of here.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. Paul Costello, Executive Director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development. Too much to discuss in just a half hour. He's retiring from the position after 21 years. We'll take a break, come back with Paul. And don't forget, tonight we got the Sox. They head out to the Pacific Northwest, taking on the Seattle Mariners. Two clubs battling for a wild card playoff spot. Our coverage begins at 9:10, first pitch at 10:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Paul Costello is with me. He's the Executive Director of the Vermont Council of Rural Development. He's retiring this month, and I'm holding him hostage for another 15 minutes, trying to extend his reign as the Executive Director at the Council. And you can call in at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Let's go to Starksboro, talk to Rich. Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Rick, and good morning, Paul. I just want to call to tell you, I was at the Middlebury conversation session that you had back when you said about every generation or so we should kind of review where rural Vermont wants to head and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the gas prices were approaching $5 an hour. We were really thinking that. And I was suggesting maybe we're going to have to deforest some of our forests to have grow crops and put it back in agriculture, because we let a lot of it grow back up over the last century. But at any rate, I really remember that experience, and I really appreciate Paul managing that. He's such a great facilitator and just did a beautiful job and very inviting to anybody's opinion on that. It was really great. But I want to follow up that with a question. you've been on there 21 years. We've got almost a generation or so is getting ready to pass. Will you make sure that your replacement does this when the next generation comes up to do this?
Thanks, Rich. Absolutely. The council's much bigger than me. We have a board. It's a true council in that it looks at everything we learn from communities and from all the voices like yours at that session, and it adds it up. And it says, what are the fundamental things that Vermont's wrestling with and what are the historic issues that rural communities have to adapt to? And then it thinks at the policy level, what should we be promoting? What should we share with the governor and legislators? And what's within our power as a convener to bring people together across lines in the bureaucracy, across political lines to say, how do we work from what we agree on as Vermonters to lift ourselves up rather than just, fight battles in the political arena? And so that exercise we did for the Council on the Future of Vermont probably 11 years ago, Rich, in Middlebury, is something that we've – sort of part of our DNA and that we're redoing now, looking at where we are 10 years later and especially in the wake of COVID and the national challenges we've been facing and the fact that we're going to have significant federal investment. We're really saying that this is a catalytic point for Vermont's future, and it's really important for people to come together again. And so we're doing a lot of convening around that big picture and bringing it down to practical projects.
It's great to hear that Rich was part of that 11 years ago and the impact it had on him being heard. How can Vermonters as individuals help the rural communities in the state?
Well, democracy is not about – it's not a passive sport, right? It's not you go in and vote once a year. People – are actively engaged every day. When people are watching out for their neighbors or in COVID they're delivering food or they're helping drive someone to the doctor's appointment or they're serving on the school board or planning commission, they're actively looking at helping to drive their community forward. And it's like the threads of that in a community, how much weave is there, is all about the strength of the community. And it's also the strength of our democracy. We are often the end of a night, we're all exhausted in a small town at the end of a road where people are trying to gather their courage to have faith that they can change and build a better community for the future. And this is something that, a lot of messages tell us we can't do anything anymore. A lot of messages are on the dark side around the challenges we face as a country, the challenges democracy faces, and we're often in a situation where we say, the center of world democracy is not in Paris or in Washington, D.C. or in Montpelier. It's right here in your hometown when you line up together to take power and do good things together, and where you're not doing it to fight against each other,
right,
but you're doing it to add up the positive and what you can drive together that will make your town a better place to live in the future. And that feeling is out there in Vermont, and it's our greatest hope, I think, as a state.
I think it's why people are here, those who move here, those who stay here, exactly those reasons. Paul, if I could grant you three wishes as you leave this position, three wishes for the future of Vermont's rural communities, what would they be?
What a great question. I don't know. I guess the first is that people look for the best in each other and bring it out. Don't just concentrate on problem statements. It's easy to build the problem statement of 50 things and bring it to your select board and complain to them constantly. It's easy to become paralyzed by the challenges that we face. So the first would be to listen and look for the best. The second would be you've got to make priorities. I was on a school board one time where the superintendent came in and said, we could try to do 40 things this year. We'll fail at all of them. But if we choose two or three and we drive on those with all the force that we have, we can get those two or three done, and it will set the atmosphere of progress and change that will leaven through everything else we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. and we get those three done, and we're going to be ready for the next. But if we don't prioritize, we're not going to get anything done. And then I think we have to think big about the kinds of challenges we're facing with climate change. COVID has been incredibly tough. And, you know, we were on the line watching, you know, these county sessions and interviewing people and seeing people at the end of their rope, morally, physically exhausted, and planning with great diligence and dedication for something that they didn't even know what was going to happen next week. Mm-hmm. But Governor Scott, his administration, and the leadership of people throughout the state who've you know, worked together to address COVID has been pretty inspiring. The fact that we followed science, and science has given us some step-by-step procedural things to do. They're still not perfect, and we're still wrestling with challenges, but we've done really well because of our mutual dedication as a people. And we need to take that same level of dedication and scientific knowledge and rationality to the conversation about climate change. And in that conversation, we can say, well, we're a small place in the world. There's nothing we can do about it. And thereby be freed of responsibility as citizens. That's not a great outcome. The other side is we can bemoan. We can attack each other. We can be critical. And there's a place for activism. There's a place for the tension that's necessary to drive change. But we also have to think about, well, what can we do? What's practical? And what's the point of unity for shifting things in the economy and in the climate arena? And fundamental to that is looking at the fact that an economy is the intersection of humanity and the environment. And when you think about climate, it's all about economic change. And what are the kinds of economic changes and entrepreneurs and other folks that are going to help provide the prosperity that will build people's lives for the future that are going to be systems answers? And that includes everything from Beta Technologies up at the airport in Burlington that are going to be creating 500 jobs. They're designing how to have battery storage for airports all across the country and how to have a vertical lift flight based on electricity versus fossil fuels. It's going to be about weatherization at scale in Vermont. It's going to be about battery storage and smart grid systems that maximize the value of electric and give us more sustainability and more control so that we're not having blackouts or anything like that. But anyway, there's a whole set of tremendous economic opportunities that we can attract, we can create, and that are already here, you know, in terms of the number of clean energy jobs, that by emphasizing, we can kind of put Vermont as a rural place at the forefront of this as a movement. And when you think about the larger setting for rural development, the biggest challenge is attracting our own kids and the next generation of kids beyond Vermont who want to be in a place that's purposive, that's diverse, that's creative, that's dynamic, that has broadband, so that they can actualize their potential in the future, both in terms of community and economy. And we're situated there, but we have to seize the day. So that's probably my fourth wish, is that we actually seize the day, take charge, step forward, be aggressive, be bold, and realize the best in Vermont.
You've earned a fourth wish. Paul Costello is the executive director of the Vermont Council on Rural Development, retiring from the position after 21 years. Paul, thank you for so many years of service, and thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks for giving me the extra 15 minutes. I hope I didn't make you late for a meeting, but it was great having you.
Yeah, nice of you, Rick. Really appreciate being on. Thank you.
All right. I had a week of being with family and friends. I was awash in love and laughter for most of that time. If you'd like to share some joy that you've experienced in your life lately, love to hear that. Of course, open phones, open topics, whatever you'd like to talk about. A couple weeks ago, I asked if there were certain things Vermonters tell us Flatlanders when we first get here, things that throw us off a bit. I've got a couple responses on that, so I'll read those in a moment. But let's first go to Hardwick, talk to Karen. Hi, Karen. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Good to hear from you.
I'm just wondering, how many people are aware of Vermont's barbaric fish and wildlife laws?
Explain
right now,
that.
We're in the midst of the first of two bear hunting seasons, which means if you buy a license, you can kill any bear. You can kill a mother with cubs. You can kill the cubs. You can hunt them with dogs, bows and arrows. And it's not the kind of thing you'd expect of Vermont law.
Well,
and
now
we have
Karen, you know, I guess I'm not speaking for Fish and Wildlife, but in interviewing Fish and Wildlife administrators through the years, I know, you know, hunting seasons are in place to keep bear, deer, et cetera, moose, to certain numbers because of what we as humans are willing to, quote unquote, accept.
Well, there's such a thing as ethical hunting.
Okay.
Where you go out and you get a deer and you butcher it and eat it.
Right.
These people are killing these bears mostly for the value of their bladder or to leave them in their pickup truck until they rot while you see a six or seven butt cracks standing around gawping at them. And there's no excuse to murder six-month-old cubs.
All right.
But that's what we allow. And the dog business, they'll hunt the bears until they tree them. But if a bear won't run, the dogs will attack, and the dogs are mutilated. It's not a thing that a civilized society would allow.
All right. I will do more research on that, Karen, see what I can learn. It does sound barbaric, you know, what you're telling me, and I appreciate you calling about that. So if there is someone, is a bear hunter and can refute and say that those things are not allowed by state law, I'd like to hear it. But if Karen is correct, it does indeed sound like more than Vermont would normally allow when it comes to hunting season, that cubs can be taken, that dogs are allowed to tree them and attack them. So hopefully that is not the case in most bear hunting, and it's those who are skirting rules is a small minority. But Karen, let me check in on that. All right, I did want to get back to certain things that Vermonters tell us newbies when we get here, and I heard from Barry in Burlington. He wrote, quote, "My story about teaching non-Vermonters the truth was the time I was with the food co-op. One day on checking in the new delivery, we received some very dark maple syrup. I grew up getting fancy grade, so I explained that in Vermont we use the dark syrup to fill potholes. I said it with a straight face. They were all amazed that it was used that way here in Vermont. So for those who Barry led astray those years ago, the dark maple syrup is not used to fill potholes, as a matter of fact. The grade C for a long time could not be sold, and that just went – or sold commercially. It went to, like, kitchens, to restaurants, things like that, for use that way. All right. I also asked on that show if switchel was a joke that you all play on newbies. And Linda wrote, quote, "My understanding is that switchel is indeed a real old-time drink, or let's say the Old Farmer's Almanac talks about it. From years of haying, I can say it works." And switchel is the official drink, I think, of all those who have to hay. All right, let's go to Doug in Plainfield. Doug, go right ahead.
I know about the bladder thing being worth a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of a Vermonter hunting bears for the bladder.
Yeah.
Two, pretty much everybody I know that hunts bears eat the bear.
Mm-hmm.
And then use their hides for a rug or whatever it may be.
Right.
I've never seen anybody riding around with the bear in their truck to eat. That's just a waste of food right there.
Right. And, Doug, I've had bear meat. I think it's absolutely delicious when it's prepared properly, dressed right. So you know, explain to people what bear is like.
It's kind of hard to explain. It's not like venison. It's say it's somewhere in between liver and a ribeye, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Most people I know, when they cook it on a grill, they cook it next to a ribeye or something to get the flavor from the ribeye to put into the bear meat.
Oh, interesting.
The dog thing, I kind of am agreeing with it. That is kind of an unethical way of hunting. Not only for the bear, but also the dog.
Is that allowed by state laws?
Yes.
It is.
Special permit for it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to hunt that way, but people still get their dogs and get their permits and things like that.
All right, Doug, you're breaking up, but thanks for that call. I do appreciate some clarification, and I promise we'll get someone on from Fish and Wildlife to talk more about bear hunting as we come into that season. Karen, you started this discussion, and I'm thankful for that. All right, let's get a quick call in. We got about a minute left. Jim's in Barrie. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Have you been following the flag controversy in Barrie City?
I have not. Has this been going on for a while, or is this something brand new?
Well, it started, I guess, sometime last week. 20 years ago, a big flag was made, and they wanted to hang it on 9/11, and they wanted to hang it again. And apparently there were some issues with city council. They said no. But anyway, the reason for calling is they did hang a flag on the park. I had quite a turnout to commemorate 9/11. But we also showed, because I was involved 20 years ago, not in this one, but 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We showed a flag that I brought down that was made 20 years ago by all the people in Barrie in 3x3 squares that they all sent to the high school, and the high school kids sewed it all together. It really is a community treasure. People autographed it and put sentiments on it and poems and pictures. And anyway, that I brought that down there, and they showed it on the park. And since then, it has now been hung in the fire station.
Oh.
And I really encourage people to go to the fire station and see it. It's a community treasure. It really showed how the community had come together right after 9/11. It took probably a month for them to make it.
Jim, that's beautiful. I'm going to cut you off, but I'm so glad that it's being displayed, that it will be there for people to see, and people can go to I would imagine they can just drop by the fire station there in Barrie and see that. Jim, thank you. That needed to be said. That brings me great joy. All right. I'm going to close the phones, and next hour we could use your help. It's the book show, so we love your suggestions throughout that entire hour. And coming up today at 1 o'clock, Charlie Papillo has Travels with Charlie. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with that big daddy of folk, bluegrass, and Americana, Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. All right, listeners, for the next hour, you'll be getting some great book suggestions from our two guests. It's our quarterly book show, when you'll learn about fiction, nonfiction, children's books, maybe even some audio books. Here to guide us through the stacks is Amy Olson, the library director at the Lanfer Memorial Library in Hyde Park. Amy, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You're welcome. And we have the co-owner of Bear Pond Books in downtown Montpelier, Claire Benedict. Claire, so great to have you back with us as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. All right, listeners, if you'd like to share some books that you've read recently, you can call us, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. New or old, if something has inspired you recently, let us know. Claire, why don't you start us with something you've read recently that you're pretty excited about?
Okay. Well, I got to tell you, my favorite book right now is called Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder. And this is a story of a woman who's a young mother. She's an artist who gave up her career to stay home and take care of her son, but she's feeling a little stifled by the demands of day-to-day motherhood. And she finds instead freedom in these nightly adventures she goes on as this free, instinct-driven dog who is roaming the neighborhood at night and delving into chaos. And, I mean, it sounds wild, and it is wild. It is an incredible story, very creative, very powerful, and it's a lot about, like, what women do when the roles that society has laid out for them is not enough. Where do they go? And I think it's, like, a great commentary on modern motherhood and really powerful and creative and pretty funny, too.
What a creative concept. Now, I'm just thinking of Rachel Yoder, you know, going to a publisher and saying, no, no, honestly, you'll love this when I write this book. Here's what I have in mind.
It sounds crazy, but it actually works.
Okay, Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder. Amy, how about you?
Well, you know, I'm a fan of, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and one I read, listened to recently is John Grisham's latest book. It came out in April, so it's been out for a little bit, but it's Sully by John Grisham. It's a departure from his legal thrillers, and I read an interview with John Grisham that said he wrote this book as an answer to missing the NCAA tournaments in 2020 due to COVID. So the story starts out in South Sudan prior to the peace agreement of 2020. The country is in civil war. And teenager Samuel Suleiman is selected to join a team to play basketball in a tournament in the United States. Not because he's a great player, because he's not. But there's something that the coaches see in him that they dislike. So while he's in the United States, back in South Sudan, his village is burned, his father is killed, his sister is missing, and after a harrowing journey, his mother and brothers eventually make it to a refugee camp in Uganda. And through luck and a little bit out of sympathy, Samuel is given a scholarship to play basketball at North Carolina Central, where he's given the nickname Sully. And again, he's not a strong player, but he practices so much every day, and finally he gets a chance to play. And Grisham switches between Sully's life in the United States and his family in the refugee camp in Uganda. And so we followed these two separate journeys, and listening to the audio was a real treat because not only is it read by the excellent Dion Graham, who was voted Booklist's voice of choice, but he describes the basketball games. It makes it feel like you're listening to a radio on the radio,
Wow.
game. And so that part of the book was really fun, and it had me chanting, "Sully, Sully," along with the rest of the crowd.
Oh, I love it. Sully by John Grisham. And that's funny. I have not heard the name Suleiman since Neil Diamond had a song out back in the 60s. It was, you know, maybe two or three hits after Sweet Caroline. And it was the first time I'd ever heard you know, the use of kind of African rhythms in a song. I was really intrigued by that music, that song, and now Suleiman is back. It's Sully by John Grisham, and you loved it on the audiobook. That's really neat. I'll tell you the one I'm reading right now. I'm not sure, has it come out? I got an advanced copy of Louise Penny's The Madness of Crowds, very topical, and they're back in Three Pines, or just at a little college right next to Three Pines, and there's this mathematician who has used numbers and is espousing euthanasia and is really tearing people apart. And, of course, Armand Gamache is right in the middle of it with his crew from the Sûreté de Québec. And it's wonderful. It's great to have Louise Penny back and the crew back in in Three Pines. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255 if you want to share a book. Claire, it's up to you again. Where do you want to go this time?
Well, I have one. This is a little bit cheating because it's not coming out till next month.
But that's all right.
It's a Vermont author, and it's a Vermont setting, and I really want to tell people about it because I really like this book a lot. It's called North by Brad Kessler, and it also involves a refugee story. It's the story of this young woman, Saro. She's a Somalian refugee, and she's trying to get to Canada. You get her full backstory through, and it's really quite harrowing and moving. And she's trying to reach Canada, and she ends up on a Vermont hilltop after an accident in an ice storm. And she's taken in by an aging monk who is living in a monastery. And it's kind of vaguely Northeast Kingdom, sounds like, in this monastery. And we get the two stories of these two very different people. This man who's decided to live his life in seclusion, and this woman who is trying to reinvent her life in the most dramatic way. And it's really a beautifully compassionate story about the different ways people seek sanctuary in their lives and the different reasons why people have to seek sanctuary. And I just was really impressed with the writing in the story. And, it, of course, it has this lovely Vermont setting, which we love. But just really nicely done. And you can tell that Kessler has done, I believe he works with Somali refugees in Vermont, and he really knows the history and the story there. So it's very respectfully done.
North by Brad Kessler. As you were describing it, some of it reminded me of a beautiful book from a few years ago, Claire. You might remember The Weight of Snow, which was set just across the border. I'm back in Quebec for the second time. But Christian Guay Poliquin, probably not getting that French pronunciation just right, but it was a massive snowstorm and two men kind of trapped in a home together. Doesn't, you know, have quite the same storyline, but again, if you enjoy stories about snow in the winter, that would be another one, The Weight of Snow. But this one is North by Brad Kessler, coming out in October. Sounds great. How about you, Amy?
Well, I read a book that was originally published in 2015, but was released in 2020 with an added chapter. It's called The Year of Living Danishly, Uncovering the Secrets of the World's Happiest Country by Helen Russell. It's a nonfiction book. Helen Russell left her job as editor of Mary Claire in London to move to Denmark, where her husband had gotten a job at Lego. And since she's a journalist, and since Denmark is consistently the happiest country on earth, according to the United Nations World Happiness Report, Helen Russell decides to take a year to uncover why. So each chapter in the book focuses on a different month in the calendar year, and she humorously relates her experiences as living in Denmark for the first time, but each month she also focuses on a different aspect of Danish happiness. So things like how easy it is to get health care, child care, and education. Divorce is easy. People drink a lot. Things like that. So it's funny and it's interesting. And also the postscript to the 2020 edition is that she gives updates about the current political climate in Denmark, how Denmark reacted to COVID, and also about racism in Denmark. And Helen Russell has spent a lot of time since she wrote this book writing about happiness, but in October she has a new book coming out called How to Be Sad, Everything I've Learned About Getting Happier by Being Sad.
Oh, my. So this is The Year of Living Danishly, Uncovering the Secrets of the World's Happiest Country by Helen Russell. And, Amy, are you you're not up in sticks and moving off to Denmark on us, are you?
No, but I am of Danish descent,
so
it did cross my mind.
Oh, that's great. I'll take a page from Amy. This is one from a few years ago. It's an audio book. My sister put it in my hands about a month ago, and I listened to George Washington's Secret Six, The Spy Ring That Saved the American Revolution. It's by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. If there's any knock, Brian Kilmeade, one of the authors, does the narration, and he's not good. But the book is so well written, the information is so interesting that you kind of overlook it for the five discs and learn all about this wonderful spy ring that George Washington set up. You also learn that Nathan Hale really didn't do a whole lot, even though he's remembered as for his spying. He lasted about 10 days as a spy for the United States. But it's a really interesting book, George Washington's Secret Six by Brian Kilmeade and Don Yeager. Let's get a suggestion from Dick, who's calling from Waterbury. Dick, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, and you?
Wonderful. What do you got?
Good, good. Well, first, I guess I've read most of the John Grisham series of books. I really like him. But I've recently started reading a lot of World War II books. Pearl Harbor was one. And two books that I'm currently reading are, I can't tell you the authors, Code Girls. This is all the young ladies who broke the Japanese codes. And helped us tremendously in World War II, particularly at Midway and other battles. And they saved countless lives and their abilities to break those codes. The other book
I'll give the author reading, there. The author is Liza Mundy on Code Girls, in case people need to know. Okay. What else you got?
And the other book that I'm currently reading is A Promised Land on President Obama. This is a very long book. It's, gosh, well over 600 pages. And it's less about Obama than it is really what it takes to actually run the White House, lead the country. People have no idea about the number of decisions that have to be made on a daily basis. We hear about the big ones, but we don't hear about all the small ones that are in totality just as impactful.
Mm-hmm.
So I would highly recommend that book. It doesn't have to be Obama. It can be any book on any president and the workings of the White House.
All right. Pulling back that curtain to let us know what it is like to actually lead a country and all the kind of minutiae that you have to attend to, as well as the big decisions. Dick, thanks for those suggestions. Great call. Dick likes all the John Grisham books, Pearl Harbor, Code Girls, and A Promised Land, that one by President Obama. All right, Amy, your turn. What would you like to suggest?
Well, piggybacking on Dick's call, I think I'll talk about a book by George W. Bush. He's been painting in his spare time as a retired president of the United States, and he put together sort of a coffee table book called Out of Many, One, Portraits of America's Immigrants. It came out in April. And truth told, I haven't read it cover to cover, but it's not that type of book anyway, in my opinion. You can just pick it up and look at the portraits that he's painted, but also accompanying them. Each portrait is of a different immigrant to the United States. And you can read their story, how they came to the United States and what they've done since they've been here and their successes. You know, having just listened to Suli, I could read the account of an immigrant from South Sudan. I have family members of Lebanese descent, so enjoyed the stories of some folks who immigrated to the United States from Lebanon. And President Bush also has famous people like Madeleine Albright and Henry Kissinger and Arnold Schwarzenegger featured in there. And at the very end, I did look at the flowchart that he included that shows four ways to U.S. citizenship, and it seemed really complicated. So that part was interesting as well.
I love it. Okay, that is former President George W. Bush. Out of Many, One, Portraits of America's Immigrants. And it is interesting to see that he's painting. He just doesn't seem like that guy. And it's really neat that he has tapped into that side of himself. So, Claire, how about you? What do you have for us?
Well, while we're on nonfiction, I have really enjoyed this book, How the Word is Passed, by Clint Smith. The subtitle is A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And what the author has done is gone on a tour of monuments and landmarks, American monuments and landmarks, and seen how the legacy of slavery is still being told in our country today. And it's a really approachable book, not like academic and dry. He's, because you're going on this tour around the country with him and talking to the people who work at these places or the people who go on tours at Confederate sites and getting their perspective on showing how we all have integrated slavery into our thinking and how it's still with us in many ways. And it's really well researched and just a really interesting perspective on race and slavery in America today.
All right. Tell us that the name of that book again.
How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith.
All right. How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. All right. Excellent. All right, I'll throw one out, and this is fiction, but it's a Vermont author, and we'll be speaking to her later this week. She lives in Vermont, teaches at Dartmouth College. It's called Embassy Wife, and it's set in Namibia. And I love, when you read a book that kind of takes you to another place, another part of the world that you've never been to, didn't really think about, never understood. And so it gives you insight into that country in South Africa, but also in Southern Africa, I should say, but also the lives, the politics that goes on in that kind of foreign service, the embassy. It's interesting. It also has humorous twists, and that is Embassy Wife by Katie Crouch. All right, Amy, you're up next. What do you have for us?
Sure. Switching to fiction, or continuing with fiction, a book that I think about a lot since I've read it. It came out in June of 2021. It's called The Other Black Girl by Zakiya Delilah Harris. It's a psychological thriller, and in it, Nella Rogers is an ambitious editorial assistant at a prestigious American publishing house. It's a fictitious Wagner Books. Nella happens to be the only black person in her department, and she's really frustrated because she's been unsuccessful in trying to make her white coworkers more aware of implicit bias, and when she has to really put her career at risk by informing a famous white male author that his black character is too stereotypical and quite flawed. So she has a lot of frustrations, but finally Wagner hires another black woman, Hazel, as an editorial assistant, and Nella thinks finally she'll have an ally who understands. But when Hazel seems to have some kind of influence over the white staff members at Nella's professional expense, and then Nella begins to get strange anonymous notes telling her to leave Wagner, she begins to wonder, who exactly is Hazel? Where did she come from? And what is she doing here? And then there's a subplot that weaves in some stuff that happened in Wagner Books past. And it all adds up to be sort of this secretive psychological thriller book. And it reminds me a little bit, last time I got to be on the radio with you, Rick, someone talked about a book called Black Buck by Matteo Ascarapur. And it kind of reminds me of that in a way, too. So, The Other Black Girl by Zakiya Delilah Harris.
All right, excellent. And how about you, Claire? You got another one for us?
I do, and mine's a little bit of a thrillery, too. It's a true story by Kate Reed Petty, and it's a story that takes place 30 years after there was a high school lacrosse team party that went bad. A girl was brought home, blacked out by two boys. They took her to her parents' house, dumped her off, and she doesn't remember any of it. And subsequently, stories abound afterwards on what happened to her with her while she was blacked out. And she is now 30 years later, and she's haunted by this night that she can't remember. She has no idea. But she's not the only one who's traumatized. Quite a number of people who were affected that night are also living with the repercussions. It's a really interesting, it's obviously a very timely book. It is also, it reads kind of like a thriller. Like, I literally could not put this book down. I just kept page turning and going, and it's very twisty. Very unexpected things happen, and the pacing is just fantastic. It's very creative storytelling, and I'll tell you, by the last page, I just, like, my mouth was hanging open. It was just the most satisfying ending of a book.
Oh, boy.
Come across in a long time. So I'm not going to tell you too much more about the story, but it is a wild ride and quite enjoyable.
I know a few people have read it and said the same thing. They love this book, True Story by Kate Reed Petty. And it does bring up, Claire, you know, that payoff at the end. You know, you really trust an author, and, you know, you're committing to 300, 400, 500, 600 pages, and you want that payoff at the end. That's just, I don't know. I don't know what we want, but you want to make sure that when you set it down at the end, that investment of time was rewarded, right?
Yeah, it's definitely one. Sometimes you can be disappointed. Like, even a good book just kind of, you know, fizzles out at the end. Not this one.
Yeah. All right, good. So we're not going to spoil the ending, other than to tell you that True Story has a great ending. And that's by Kate Reed Petty. We've got Claire Benedict and Amy Olson as our guests this hour as we talk about some great books that you can add to your list. We're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update from them, and then we'll be back for more suggestions from our guests. You can hop in the queue now, listeners, with your suggestions at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And don't worry if it's a book that has a little bit of age to it, a little bit of moss on it. We don't mind. We always love talking about books that you enjoy. Coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and we're spending the hour accumulating a full list of books for you to pick up on your next trip to the library or the bookstore. We've got Lanfear Memorial Library Director Amy Olson and Montpelier's Bear Pond Books co-owner Claire Benedict. They're helping us fill out our book list. Now, listeners, you can share your own choices. You can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. One thing I like to do is always know, you know, who's on the way. It's just like with music, who's got an album coming out in the near future, with books, what author has got something on the horizon. Ian Rankin, one of my favorites, with the Inspector Rebus series set over in Scotland. I love them. That'll be coming out, I think, later this year. Sarah Strohmeyer, who not only is the Middlesex town clerk, has written a number of wonderful books. She's got one coming out in the fall. And another Vermonter, the Joe Gunther series by Archer Mayer down there in Dummerston. That's on the way as well. So some to get excited about. Claire, any that you know of that are on the horizon that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, there's a lot. Anthony Doerr has a new book coming out, and he wrote All the Light We Cannot See, which was hugely popular. And the author of A Gentleman in Moscow, which was also a hugely popular book, has a new novel coming out called The Lincoln Highway. And I have a feeling that's going to be pretty hot. And you'll be interested to know, Louise Penny has another book coming out this fall. She has co-written a thriller with Hillary Clinton. And so God knows what that's going to be.
I know. We know it's not a gamash book, right? It's not an
inspection. Not a gamash book,
right?
But a very interesting mashup there. So, you know, who knows?
I know. That's very interesting. Not the two people on this earth I would have put together to co-author a novel. But and that's not an easy thing to do. There were the guys who did Relic and a number of those books. And I remember interviewing them once and how they did it. And one would write a chapter, they'd send it to the other, and then the their co-author would write the next chapter. They'd go back and forth, and then somehow, they would stitch it up together. But you couldn't tell who was writing what. How about you, Amy? Anything on the horizon that you're getting excited about?
Yeah, I actually had on my list both books that Claire mentioned, so definitely looking forward to those. But also Susan Orlean, who wrote the library book in 2018, has a new book coming out next month called On Animals. Mm. So I think that people who loved the library book will be looking forward to her next one.
Oh, wonderful. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Fred joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred. What's your suggestion?
Oh, mine is a very interesting book. It has to do with World War II, which was probably the third most important war we had, Revolution being the first one, Civil War being the second one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyways, the name of the book is Stalingrad, and it was written by Anthony Beevor, and it's a narration of the Battle of Stalingrad. And the background of the book is that when he wrote the book, he had total access to the Russian archives of the battle. And so he wrote this narration of the battle. And it's like a novel. It actually puts you in the shoes of any German soldier you want to deal with and Russian soldiers. It's just an unbelievable read.
All right. And that is Stalingrad by Anthony Beevor.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Fred, for that suggestion.
Anton.
Oh, Anton. I'm sorry. Anton. All right. Perfect. Boy, we're getting a lot of World War II suggestions today, and that's great. Love to hear, to get out of something that's maybe not what I'm reading, not your comfort zone, but to hear about them and think, oh, yeah, I could get into that. Claire, how about another suggestion for our listeners?
Okay, I have The Lying Life of Adults by Elena Ferrante. Elena Ferrante is the woman who wrote the My Beautiful Friend trilogy that people love so much. And this is a new book. This stands alone. It's not part of that storyline, but it also takes place in Naples. It's a little more, it's more recent. I think it's like the 70s or the 80s. They don't really say. And it's about Giovanna, who's a teenage girl in Naples, and she's kind of growing up and realizing that her parents aren't so perfect, and that her parents are, nothing new, right? But her parents are very refined and educated people, and she really looks up to them, and she's starting to see, like, the cracks in the perfection, and this drives her to start kind of idolizing the black sheep of the family, who is her aunt, who lives in a rough part of town and is not well educated and who her parents look down on. So, of course, Aunt Vittoria becomes really interesting to Giovanna. Mm. And she goes back and forth between these two worlds of her parents' refinement and Aunt Vittoria's rougher life. And it's really an interesting kind of coming of age, learning the hard truths about the world and about adults and growing up. And it just has Elena Ferrante's wonderful writing. And you just kind of sink into Naples in not the glorified way that we do as tourists, but what it's really like to live in Italy. And I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, I love it. The Lying Life of Adults by Elena Ferrante. That really sounds interesting. And how about you, Amy? What do you have for us?
Well, I have a little bit of a frivolous, guilty pleasure pick.
We're allowed those.
It came out a couple weeks ago. We sure are. It's called The Last Chance Library by Freya Sampson. It takes place in a small English village, and June Jones is the library assistant, and she's been living her whole life in this small village. She still lives in the house where she grew up, and she spends most of her free time reading. It's a sweet little simple kind of story. The library is clearly the heart of the community. However, the village council has to make some budget cuts, so the library might be forced to close, and that's when all these really cute cast of characters in the community come together to try to save the library.
Oh, I love it. The Last Chance Library by Freya Sampson. You had me at set in a small town in England. I was there right at that point. Let's go back to the phones. Waterbury Center is where we're headed next. Let's hear from George. Hi, George.
Hi, good morning.
Is this George? Is this George?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, all right.
I know I got to call you back sometime. I will.
George Woodard,
I've been
great to have you.
Like a madman.
Good. Well, all right. Better to be busy than the reverse, right?
The book I've been reading, and I've actually read it once through, and I keep going back every day and looking at different pieces of it. It's called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. And I was, I'm going to turn my radio down here. I was looking, location searching down Chelsea, and I heard this advertised on the radio when I was coming back. And I went right to the bookstore in Waterbury and ordered a copy of it. And it's such a great book because it talks all about, it really in depth talks about the whole blacklist, the McCarthy era, and the House Un-American Activity, and how it affected a lot of the people in the film industry, and how High Noon was trying to be made, and the problems they went through with everything and stuff. It's just a fun book to read, especially if you know a little bit about it. But if you don't, it's still a really good book. It's called High Noon: The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of American Classic by Glenn Frankel. Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, Frankel with one L.
All right. The High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, The Making of an American Classic. Reminds me, in a way, of our friend Rick. Now his last name is escaping me, who owned the Savoy.
Rick.
And his book on, the Red Scare in Vermont. Has some similar overlap to that.
Right. I saw his talk about that actually down in Chelsea at the town hall there. We went into that.
Yeah, that was interesting. What an era that was. So this is High Noon, the Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic.
You can't believe how it affected people. It's amazing.
Anyway, wow.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, George.
I know Amy.
Oh, good. George Woodard, great to have you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, Bye. Take care. Who do we hear? Beth says, this is my absolute favorite show, but I'm crazy busy this morning. Are you keeping a list? I will put together a list for you, Beth, and make sure that you get it, what we are discussing here this morning. So, and try to put that. I'll probably put it on Facebook. I think that's the easiest, on the DEV Facebook page for people to access. I want to throw one out because we don't give a ton of love to poetry, but Jack T. Scully is a Vermont author. He's written Mianus Village. And it's the earthier side of Greenwich, Connecticut. So, Claire, this is kind of like a true story. I'm sorry, by The Lying Life of Adults, when you talk about the other side of Naples. This is the other side of Greenwich, Connecticut. Wonderful poetry, kind of coming of age, and some of the great characters that he grew up around in Mianus Village, which is a part of Greenwich, Connecticut. That's by Jack T. Scully. Amy, where are you taking us next?
All right. Well, talking about growing up, let's go to children's books.
Okay.
I really liked the book Amber and Clay by Laura Amy Schlitz. It was written it came out in March of 2021. It's a book for about 10 to 14-year-olds. It takes place in ancient Greece, and it tells the separate stories of two children. There's quiet, artistic, and introspective Roscos, who's born into slavery. At the age of 5, he's working in the stables, but eventually he's sold to a potter, where his artistic skills are really valued. He also befriends Socrates, who encourages him to seek freedom and be his own master. And then there's wild, headstrong Melisto, the daughter of a wealthy Athenian, favored by the goddess Artemis and beloved by her father, resented by her mother, and little Melisto is sent off to serve Artemis. Although the two children never meet in life, their stories as they unfold, we find as readers that their destinies are bound together. This book is written in verse, and I think that will appeal to children who are intimidated by a page filled with text. But it also adds to this just really lyrical, magical storytelling. and interspersed throughout the book, some of the gods of Olympus chime in as sort of a chorus to let the reader in on their perspectives as gods, particularly Hermes. He talks a lot in this one. And I think that this book will really appeal to kids who are interested in Greek mythology with the huge popularity of all the Percy Jackson books.
Right.
Kids really want more Greek mythology books. This is really different than that. This is sort of next level. But it's also appealing to kids who are interested in archaeology and historical fiction. And it's also just a great story of friendship and being true to who you are.
All right. Amber and Clay, that's by Laura Amy Schlitz. How about you, Claire?
Well, one more I want to mention that hasn't come out yet. You were asking what we were excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And Ruth Ozeki has a book that's coming out, I think, next week or in the next couple of weeks. And it's called The Book of Form and Emptiness. And she's just an author I love. And I have to say, this is one of the best books I've read in a long time.
Wow.
And it's definitely going to be at the top of my list for the year. And it's about this young boy. He's 12, 13, his name is Benny, and his mom, Annabelle, are both struggling after the accidental death of Benny's father, who was a jazz musician. And Benny starts hearing voices of the objects around him, like the objects in his home, talking. They're not talking to him, but he can hear them talking. And meanwhile, Annabelle is developing a hoarding problem, and everything she brings into the house, Benny can hear talking, and he wants to shut out the noise. And, you know, it's a very creative story. Obviously, it plays with a lot of surrealism, and but it's got, like, jazz in it. It's got climate change. It has homeless philosophers. It has a little love story. You name it. This is a sweeping kind of epic novel. And I just found it so rewarding. I, like, literally wanted to hug this book. It's kind of a book.
Wow.
It's like a book for book lovers. It talks a lot about the importance of books and of telling story. And Ruth Ozeki is a Zen, is a Buddhist nun. And so she brings this really compassionate, philosophical viewpoint to her writing. And I think it's just kind of brilliant. And I loved it.
The Book of Form and Emptiness, it's by Ruth Ozeki, comes out in a week, so get ready for that one. I'm going to mention a couple that are very similar. These are by all by part-time Vermonters, and the subject very similar, and it has to do with hiking the long trail. So if you're ever thinking of hiking the long trail, these are great books to learn what it's all about. One is by Dennis and Jane Blanchard. It's called A Short Walk on a Long Trail. The other is Walking Home by Celia Riker. And I'm not a hiker of long distance hiker. I love to walk. I love to do maybe a day hike. And these really give you, kind of warts and all what it's like to hike the long trail. And if you've ever thought about doing it, pick up these books and get a real idea of what it's like. All right, lightning round. We've got time probably for one each from both of you. So Amy, you're up first.
All right, it's coming up to be Halloween-y time. So young adult horror fiction, not my usual genre, but Five Midnights and the sequel Category 5 by Anne Davila Cardinal. She's a Morristown author and recently did a talk at the Lamphere Library. Not my usual genre, but the books are funny, scary, and have a little bit of Puerto Rican culture in it as well, with the plot characters.
All right, perfect for this time of year, Five Midnights and Davila Cardinal. Claire, what have you got for us?
We're loving the Thursday Murder Club books.
Me too!
Those are really fun. Just a great mystery, really entertaining. Richard Osman, not too grisly, just great mysteries. The Thursday Murder Club is the first one, and it's out in paperback, and there's a new one coming, so if you like it, there'll be something more for you.
And are they YA or
those are adults.
Oh, they are. Okay. Richard Osman, the Thursday Murder Club books. That sounds great. You really did, go through the lightning round with lightning quickness. So we do have time for one more from each. Claire, what do you want to tell us about?
What else do I have? I mean, you're running through my list.
All's
here.
Well. Mona.
Yes, All's Well by Mona Awad. It's a new novel
that came out earlier this year that is about a college theater professor with chronic pain, a recent divorce, and a love of painkillers. In other words, she is a hot mess, and she's trying to put on the play All's Well That Ends Well for with her college students. And but meanwhile, they want to do Macbeth. It's kind of a wild, funny story of redemption and magic, and it's a wild ride.
Oh, fantastic. Amy, one more from you.
Oh, I want to say Claire makes all of the books that she's talking about sound amazing. My list is growing. I really liked Derek Miller's books, Norwegian by Night and American by Day. He had a new one come out in July called How to Find Your Way in the Dark, Derek Miller. It's kind of the backstory of the character from Norwegian by Night, the childhood. It's a little bit dark. It's a little bit funny. It takes place in 1938. Sheldon Horowitz's mother has died. His father has died in a car accident, but Sheldon is intent on the fact that it's not an accident. So this is an adult book, but a 12-year-old bent on revenge.
All right, How to Find Your Way in the Dark. That's by Derek B. Miller. I'll throw out another Vermont author, Sarah Storr Taylor, and I loved her Expeditioners series, but she has a new adult series called, that's the Maggie Darcy series, and I think I was in the middle of reading A Distant Grave when we did the last book show, and so I finished it, and I can highly recommend it. It's A Distant Grave by Sarah Storr Taylor. It's the second book in the Maggie Darcy series, and it takes place on Long Island and in Ireland, and I love being transported back to the lovely Isle there, where everyone is so sweet and kind and nice. So that's A Distant Grave. And also, our dear Dr. Francois Clemens from Middlebury College has a biography out, Officer Clemens, a memoir, talking about his time as Officer Clemens on the Mr. Rogers Show. And that's a really wonderful story of his life. So if you've got a chance, read that one. All right. Claire Benedict, co-owner of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. Amy Olson, library director at Lanfer Memorial Library in Hyde Park. It has been a wonderful hour. I love when the two of you join me. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks, Rick.
All right. Take care. All right. And we all have a big list of books now. And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivrigan. Our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics and guests. Love hearing from you. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Bill Sayre's up next with Common Sense Radio. I'll post the list of books on our Facebook page, the WDEV Radio Facebook page. I'm Rick Sangary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow. We'll be talking Bethel Women in History and also the Vermont State Police Major Crime Unit. See you here tomorrow. Bye.